Today on Piled High and Deep, the podcast, our journey is with a doctorate in computer science. Now, this is a journey that begins probably all the way back to elementary school or junior high. He finds electronic doohickey kits that he can build at home. So he's learning how to solder. He understands what a resistor or a capacitor is. Stuff that maybe you and I don't necessarily know or understand how they work. Well, he learns about those things, and then in high school, he gets the high-level math, and then he's introduced into computer software coding and engineering. He excels at it all. As a result, the world is his oyster. He can really go to college wherever he wants. And given all this, you might be a little surprised on what was really the driver of his college decision.
There was also the fact that I was a big Gilmore Girls fan when I was in high school. And Gilmore Girls being set in this little New England town and like romanticizing the entire notion of the little New England town, really like during those formative early high school years, cemented in my mind that going to college on the East Coast is this ideal that one aspires toward.
Okay, don't laugh. Who of us hasn't been inspired or influenced by a television show or two or three? Mine just happened to be WKRP. I always build myself as a Dr. Johnny Fever kind of guy. But I digress. We're talking about Andy Saylors here. So he ends up in this nifty Boston area college. And he finds his people. And he really finds and discovers that love of writing computer code. Not so much building the machines that the code runs on. So after graduation, he has a decision to make. More school or off to the workforce? And it really was a decision not to go to work that helped define what his dissertation was. And it also came at a time when Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning were bringing to light some important issues that we just hadn't really even thought of.
What does it mean to manage secrets in the digital age? And how do we solve those problems, both from the technology standpoint, but also what does secret management mean on the policy side, right? Like, how do we extrapolate secrets that traditionally might be within the realm of the contents of your mind and thus have protection under certain amendments people love to claim when they're on trial for things they did, to now having an entire hard drive that maybe vastly expands the contents of your mind? But
it's a PhD journey of computer science, but it's not all sciencey. It's more than just the ones and zeros in code. It's about the attitudes of privacy, access, and security. Piled High and Deep is created by Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conte Jr. Please check out my website at themountaingeek.net. Also have some other ramblings, and you can find previous episodes of Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Also put some writing on there occasionally when I am so struck. I need to be struck more to be writing. And want to say thanks to my neighbor, Mike Scott, for setting Andy Saylor and I up. Great conversation. Another little interesting reference point in this is that Andy is a graduate of the same high school that my daughter went to and that my son is currently at. So it was interesting putting that issue together, and not really an issue, but understanding what the opportunities are better for high school kids coming out and heading off to college. I'm going to stop rambling and let's start shoveling. Andy Saylor is up next on Piled High and Deep, the podcast. In high school, did you see yourself getting that PhD?
Sure. So when I was in high school, I don't think I really planned to get a PhD. I was planning to go to college and get a technical degree. It was electrical engineering was kind of my original topic I wanted to study. But then I saw myself going through college and going into the workforce and taking advantage of an electrical engineer's salary and all the other nice things that come with the territory.
Before we go down exactly what that path was, what is it that you do now?
Sure. So right now I am a security engineer for Twitter. So I work on the Twitter information security team dealing with a wide range of things. It's a relatively small information security team for a company that has as many customers or as many users as Twitter has. So that means we have to touch a lot of different things. So we deal with everything from kind of securing user data to securing employees and employee laptops and all of the data employees have access to kind of ensuring the usability of our system and ensuring that users can use Twitter securely and can log in securely and all the other things that kind of fall under the umbrella of information security in the 21st century.
I'm guessing your age, you're not quite 30 yet.
Yeah, this is correct. I am 29.
Okay.
Man, I have to think about it.
you are that millennial kid who grew up with a computer in the home. I'm sure that it was a big focus of your young life. Would that be correct?
Yeah, to some extent. Early on, I was definitely more interested in electrical engineering. So we always had a computer growing up, and I'd play the computer games. And I definitely got early on into building my own computers from parts and instead of buying them off the shelf and stuff like that, mainly driven by wanting to play fancier computer games, right? Not some grand altruistic theme of like just liking building computers. But I was definitely into that when I was in kind of middle school and in high school. And did a lot of that kind of stuff. But a lot of my hobby projects in the engineering realm were more in the traditional electrical engineering space, like building little audio amplifiers and soldering things in my basement and that kind of thing. It wasn't so much the programming front. I did a little bit of programming in high school. I took APCS, but I would flirt with programming here and there, but I certainly wasn't into it at the level that some people would be.
Bad guy, didn't turn off my phone here. What... Going to college and as we had talked about it early on, you grew up in the same neighborhood essentially that my kids are in, same high school. It's an affluent high school, Cherry Creek High School, in the outskirts of Denver. And I can tell you that as a parent of kids that are in that school, my wife went there. The expectation going to high school there is that every kid that goes to Cherry Creek is going to go to college. Was that the expectation even just in your house?
Yeah, I think it certainly was. I mean, both my parents went to college. They both are employed in professions that require college degrees. I mean, it's definitely kind of the you go to college thing was a general expectation. Having said that, I actually did know people at Creek that participated in some of the kind of more trade-oriented programs, especially around some of the pilot-type stuff or the professional photography stuff that they offered. And I did some photography while I was there. I was always envious of those kids because they got access to the nice dark rooms, whereas, you know, us non-pre-professional people just got the inferior art dark rooms instead of the actual professional level stuff that the people kind of going through trade programs got. But yeah, in my household, that was definitely the expectation. Had I decided I wanted to go directly into a trade or something, I'm sure my parents would have been supportive of it. But the assumption was always just you kind of go to college after you graduate high school.
What were your best subjects in middle school or junior high? Were you a math kid?
Yeah, I was definitely the maths and sciences. Cherry Creek actually has some engineering courses at the high school level, which is pretty rare. But I took the kind of engineering science program they had there that lets you, in addition to my regular science classes, would focus more on things like instrumentation and doing little electronics projects and things that would fall more traditionally in kind of the applied sciences realm versus the pure sciences that you'd take via the AP classes. So I had the luxury of doing both. This is one of the great things about attending a high school that has four dedicated buildings and a course book a quarter inch thick. But yeah, it was definitely kind of the maths and sciences were my strongest subjects.
Are there specific teachers there that you remember that were... you know, impactful on you, whether it was at middle school or...
Yeah, there's definitely a couple, some of whom I'm still in touch with. So Steve Lohman, I don't think he's, I think he's since retired, but he used to run kind of the engineering science program there at Cherry Creek and did for many years. He was also the cross-country coach, which I was involved with for 1 year until I decided running every day after school was not, you know, my best idea of a good time. But he definitely, I took kind of multiple semesters of courses with him because there was this progression of engineering courses, and I always really appreciated the fact that he was doing that work and teaching those kind of classes that you wouldn't have access to at most high schools. I also went through a lot of the AP courses and took classes with TJ Donahue, who I think is still at Creek. I see him about once a year still, so he and I have stayed in touch. And he definitely, too, probably had some subconscious effect, at least on me getting a PhD, because he was one of the few teachers I had in high school who had a PhD himself and had kind of gone down that track and had gone to school in Boston. He got his PhD from MIT. So we had, when I ended up going to Boston, it was kind of the we'd both gone to college in Boston type experience. But
there's a lot of colleges in Boston.
There are. It's easy to find alignment with other people who went to college in Boston, for better or worse. But yeah, both those individuals, I think, definitely had a lot of impact on kind of my high school career. With Dr. Donahue, I did the research program at Cherry Creek High School as well and kind of participated in the science fairs and the independent research project and that kind of stuff, which when I did it, I enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy it to the point where I'm like, oh man, I want to be a full-time researcher for the rest of my life, which is part of the reason I don't think I really considered doing a PhD at that stage. But down the road, getting into a PhD program, those experiences early on definitely proved helpful, having had some research background.
I'm going to bounce around here a little bit. We'll go back to the specifics of the journey, but I want to get to the research thing. You just said that you don't really find the research that interesting. Would that be, do you think that you have to have big questions to answer to be a successful PhD?
As to whether or not I find the research interesting, peer research, I can certainly appreciate. Being the person that executes it, you know, wasn't necessarily my idea of the best use of my time. It wasn't something I enjoyed that much. I think I more enjoy kind of the applied components of research, which is part of the reason why when I ended up in a PhD program, it was in the engineering side more so than the pure science side. So a pure science dissertation is going to revolve around answering some probably small but new fundamental question about the universe, right? I mean, This is kind of what pure science endeavors to accomplish. And as a PhD, you're always expected to do something new, right? You need to carve out some little new niche that hasn't been explored before. That's kind of what makes it a PhD and not a glorified master's thesis, is you're exploring a topic that in theory, no one has actually asked or answered that direct question before. On the applied side, you do something similar, but you know, it's less about asking and answering like a fundamental natural question that no one's answered before, and more about, can you build something interesting that maybe no one's built before, right? Or can you solve a problem that people know exists, but that we don't maybe have a graceful solution to yet? And the engineering, the applied side, the kind of problem solving, building, and construction side, it definitely appealed more to me than the more abstract, pure science, philosophical answer a question side of things.
All right, so we'll go, again, bounce around. It's the way that my brain works sometimes. Is that from Creek, you end up in Boston. I think you said Tufts for mm-hmm. the undergrad. How do you get to, how do you find Tufts? What's that process? Because, I mean, you're a Colorado kid. Sure. Was there a family connection? You had mentioned Dr. Donahue before.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's... There was no family connection with Tufts. And the reason I wound up at Tufts, you know, there are many other places I probably could have wound up. So when I was starting to look at colleges junior year, like you do, I definitely went and looked at the Colorado schools and I applied to them because CU is a great school. You know, Mines is a good school. There are definitely good options here. But overall, I was kind of interested in seeing some other parts of the country. And I really wanted the East Coast to be that other part of the country. So I focused a lot of my search on kind of the East Coast area, and particularly Boston, because it does have that density of colleges and options. If you really extract why I, you know, wanted to pick the East Coast over other things, I've never been thrilled with the West Coast. I think I've always been philosophically more of an East Coast person. I like old cities. I like, you know, the history. I don't mind the weather. I like good falls. I like the color changing. I don't need beach days and stuff like that. But there was also the fact that I was a big Gilmore Girls fan when I was in high school, and Gilmore Girls being set in this little New England town and like romanticizing the entire notion of the little New England town, really like during those formative early high school years, cemented in my mind that going to college on the East Coast is this ideal that one aspires toward. So yeah, that's what it came down to. I applied to a lot of colleges in Boston. I got into a subset of those I applied to. I kind of went out to visit the ones I got into, namely University of Boston and Tufts were the two ones that I had applied to and gotten into. Boston University, I don't know how much you know about Boston, it's a great school, but it's bigger. It's almost CU's size. It's a, you know, 20,000-30,000 person university, which of course means great labs, great research programs, but also means huge, you know, bigger classes just in terms of the number of people you're graduating with, means as a freshman you're living in a skyscraper in basically what amounts to downtown Boston. Whereas Tufts has more of that residential campus feel. You know, it's much smaller. Tufts is a little bit bigger than Creek overall. Tufts is about 4,000 people, so 1,000 person per class, whereas Creek was 800. So that both meant that it had kind of the more personal touch, but it had the residential campus. You were living in more of a dorm. You had grass to walk around. You weren't like, I loved being near a city, but I wasn't necessarily thrilled with spending 4 years living in downtown in a major city. So it came down to Tufts versus BU, and Tufts kind of carried the day in terms of it was the size I was looking for. It had more of the residential campus experience I was looking for. And although it looks a lot like a little liberal arts East Coast school, it in fact has a very good engineering program, which appealed to me.
And the undergrad was electrical engineering?
Yep, that's correct. Did my undergrad in electrical engineering and minored in computer science. So had kind of started to shift halfway through there. I was doing electrical engineering, and although I'd gone into electrical engineering kind of wanting to work on hardware, that's where my original passions lay. As I did more and more of it, two things kind of happened. One, the math started to get really, really hard. And I could do it, but I didn't enjoy doing it, right? Like it was a lot of effort. It's you get into some pretty gnarly math, a lot of which we just don't have good solutions to, right? So you end up having to solve it with computer programs anyway, because the best you can do is an iterative solution. Like, we don't have closed form solutions for a lot of these electrical systems as they exist in the real world. It's just too complex. So that meant I was doing a lot of programming already. And whenever I would have to work with hardware, it would be a little bit of tinkering with hardware. And then you'd spend the rest of your time coding up something to make the hardware do what you wanted anyway. So as an electrical engineer, I was spending a lot of my time coding. The coding is kind of how we were solving all the interesting problems. So when I graduated and it came time to start looking at grad schools, or when I got into senior year and started looking at grad schools, it was very much the, well, I'm spending a lot of my time programming anyway. I can get a lot more done quickly programming. I don't really want to go work for an Intel and like do silicon level design. I want to work a little higher up the stack. So it seems like computer science is where a lot of the interesting problems are and where a lot of the interesting solutions are going to be versus trying to keep working at the hardware level itself.
So break down for me then the difference. So you have electrical engineering and computer science. And then is there a subset in there as well for where does the engineering of computer science fall in?
Sure. So it's, I mean, depending upon where you're at, there's a lot of overlap between all these disciplines, right? So I used to tell people the kind of electrical engineering I was doing was basically high-level electrical engineering, and the kind of computer science I was doing was basically low-level computer science, and those are effectively the same disciplines.
Because when I think of computer science, I'm thinking of guys that are really just writing code.
Yeah, and you get
some of
those.
Am I wrong there?
Well, it's a big spectrum. So I like to think about computer science kind of as existing on a spectrum between people that should have studied pure math on one end and people like me who are reformed electrical engineers on the other end, right? So you get a handful of people in the computer science community that can't write code. They basically sit around all day and solve really hard math problems, many of which in kind of the discrete realm, some of which having to do with cryptography or having to do with kind of these other fundamental discrete math problems that very much underlie the theoretical side of computer science, right? So yeah, at the end of the day, we need to go and build a computer. But even before we could build computers, we had these kind of theoretical mathematical notions of binary computation and what you could do with that. And there is still an entire discipline that kind of exists on that side of the computer science realm. And it's very mathy and it's very abstract. And it may or may not map to ever writing any code. On the other side of computer science, you do get that kind of computer engineering realm. You get the how do we actually build computers today, which, of course, 20 years ago meant figuring out how to make solder together a series of transistors and build a small computer. Today, a lot of that means how do you etch silicon and how do you kind of do these really low-level designs to build microchips and build CPUs and the other low-lying kind of computer chips that are necessary, which all rests on very basic primitives. When you're an electrical engineer or when you're a computer scientist, you almost always take a class where you build some very basic kind of computation tools, straight out transistors on a breadboard. And of course, this is like a 4-bit computer that can add and multiply numbers and maybe process some if statements. And it uses 100 odd transistors or something like that. And you can solder it together by hand. Of course, it's not useful for any practical purpose today, but it's useful for kind of illustrating that's the same thing your computer you use today is. It's just scaled down several orders of magnitude. So the people doing work at Intel or designing computer chips or kind of specializing in that basically are refining the art of how we take these basic primitives we've been building for 20 years and how do we make them smaller, how do we make them faster, how do we make them more power efficient. There are some architectural tweaks in there, and people doing pure architecture are going to like want to hang me, right? But there is some architectural cleverness we've added, but at the end of the day, a lot of the core components inside that Intel CPU in your computer are the same core components that have been in every computer for the last 30 years. We've just refined them.
made them smaller and stuffed more of them onto
onto that
chip.
More or less. And added some few new ones here and there. There's definitely been the rise of GPU computing and some of these kind of newer notions. And more as we get toward the limits of what you can shrink in silicon and you know, to the point where we're kind of hitting physical limits of the universe in terms of how big an electron is and what that means about how small of a CPU you can build. We have had to get a little bit more clever on the architectural front because we can't just keep following Moore's law and shrinking and assuming we will decrease cost while increasing transistor density and decreasing power consumption. That's getting harder and harder to do. So that does mean now architecture maybe gets to have this other heyday where we go, well, we can't make it smaller anymore, but maybe we can change the way we build it. So there may be some of that. That, of course, isn't my specialty. My specialty is kind of the next step up above that, which is the systems level computer programming. Within the spectrum, you have electrical engineering on one side, you have pure math on the other. Everything in the middle then is kind of the various levels of software development, ranging from systems level programming, which has a lot to do with operating systems and kind of the how do you write that layer of software that tends to run more or less right on top of the computer processor itself. So that's where I got my start, was in the systems lab, which traditionally is kind of low-level computer science. So you're definitely writing code, but you tend to be writing code in languages like C and languages that have been around for a while that exist a little closer to the hardware that are used to write things like Linux or like Windows or like our operating systems, our networking stacks, kind of the lower-level fundamentals that then all other programs rely on. So then, of course, as you move up the stack, you get higher level languages that make assumptions about what the operating system will provide to them. Eventually, you get to things like Android apps that, you know, are relying on four or five other layers of software between them and the processor to actually abstract away a lot of these complexities and make it easier for that app developer to focus on doing what the app does and not have to worry about things like how do you actually manage the RAM that's inside that phone.
Okay.
It's layers of abstractions all the way down. There's an old saying that every problem in computer science can be solved by adding a layer of abstraction, except the problem of too many layers of abstraction. So it's basically we carve off a layer, we solve some problem with it, and then we present a new layer on top of that that doesn't have the old problem, but maybe now has a new one.
How was the decision made for you to go to, you had said earlier, you finished your undergrad, you applied for some jobs, you applied for some graduate programs, possibly PhD. I get the sense you weren't really certain exactly how far you'd continue the education. You just knew that you weren't done yet. You hadn't filled the brain completely. How did you make the decision on where to go next?
Sure. So yeah, I was basically my junior year of college. I was applying to PhD programs under the theory that I wasn't ready to be done with school yet. I wanted to spend some more time in school, and applying to PhD programs is cheaper than trying to pay for master's programs, since most PhD programs are funded. And in line with that, I wasn't sure I wanted to do a PhD program. So at the same time, I was applying to kind of entry-level jobs out of college with my electrical engineering degree. Although a lot of the jobs I was applying to were kind of more on the, I would have been doing programming work even with my electrical engineering degree. I did that minor in computer science. I had taken programming courses. I was a pretty good programmer at that stage, good enough to, you know, get into an entry-level position at least. But yeah, I did have both these. So it rolled around to senior year, and I, you know, just after Christmas or so senior year, you get your set of acceptance letters from whatever colleges, whatever grad schools you got into. At the same time, I'd started to hear back on some of these interviews. So I kind of had three or four job offers, I think, that I was sitting on. I do credit a lot of the companies I interviewed with. They were nice enough to let me sit on those offers for a couple of months, basically, while I waited to hear back from schools. And I did that was very nice. I think it was great that they did that because it did allow me really to look at all my options at once and consider them instead of kind of having to deal with this marriage problem of potentially turning down something without knowing what the next option's going to be yet. But I had all these options, and I seriously considered taking some of the jobs. I had a job offer from Bolt, Bernanke & Newman, BBN, which is a company out of Boston that is actually owned by Raytheon now and had been at the time, but is famous because back in the day, they were the company that basically built the original ARPANET nodes. They were the contractor that the U.S. government hired to build ARPANET, which is the precursor to the modern internet. So BBN goes way back in internet history. And, you know, you're sitting in their lobby, they have like the original internet router sitting right there, right? And they've done some interesting work. today they do a number of different things. I had actually, and this is kind of funny, I'd come full circle, because when I was applying to grad school, I was applying kind of to systems, thinking I'd do the same with operating systems, same with networking. I wasn't thinking so much security, except this job I had gotten an offer for at BBN was an entry-level information security job, because they have a big information security practice now, mainly doing classified work for the U.S. government. So, you know, it's on a very specific subset of information security, but there's some really smart people there. They're definitely doing interesting things, but it would have been classified work, and, you know, it would have been classified work for effectively a major defense contractor today, since it's Raytheon, who is their parent company at the end of the day. So that was probably my most interesting job offer, and it was that or kind of coming out here to Colorado and going to see you, which had turned out to be kind of the best PhD offer I'd gotten in terms of where I could go and where I could kind of work on what I wanted to work on and where I'd have funding to do that.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do for your for that next step?
Yeah, so, well, for the, so at CU, I had kind of specifically applied to the systems lab. I'd been paired with an advisor who ended up staying my advisor the whole time in the systems group. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. You know, I had a notion that I wanted to maybe do something with networking, with computer networks, something with operating systems. Again, I didn't have a real grand idea of like what I was going to work on. I just kind of knew it wasn't going to be the pure theoretical computer science, and it wasn't probably going to be way up at the top of the stack doing like user interface design or something like that. It was going to be something lower down here. So I came out and I visited Boulder. Obviously BBN was based in Boston, so taking that job would have meant staying there. I had a partner who I'm still with now, who also was kind of part of this consideration. So there was a bit of a two-body problem in terms of where she was interested in moving. She had grown up in Massachusetts, and actually in Western Massachusetts, so Boston was less of a travel for her than it had been for me, kind of seeing another part of the country. And I think she was somewhat interested in now getting that same experience of seeing another part of the country. So coming out to Boulder, turns out, really appealed to her. I knew I'd
lucky.
Like it, right? Yeah, like I'm like, oh, well, you know, Boulder's a nice place to go to grad school. I used to come up here when I was in high school. It had the advantage of I hadn't actually lived here before, so it didn't feel like I was just, you know, going back home. But it was close enough that I was familiar with it. I knew it was a nice town and it was an interesting place to go grad school. So we thought about that. And at the end of the day, I think it kind of came down to Boulder sounded like a nice place to spend the next 5 years, coupled with the I wasn't ready for a 9-to-5 job. Like, you know, I didn't want to stop school and 2 months later have to be a 40-hour work week kind of person. So I'm like, well, let's try this grad school thing. And that's kind of what landed me at CU at the end of the day.
How long was your time here?
So I moved to CU right after, basically the summer after I graduated in 2011. So I'm going on 6 years here now. It took me 5 academic years to kind of finish the PhD from start to finish. And then I've been working out here for the last year.
So what was that? I want to go down two paths here. First of all, on the academic side, what did you do to support yourself? Did you find a fully funded program? Did they pay for everything? Were you then also being a TA and that type of thing?
Sure. So the way CU does it, to the best of my knowledge, just the way they still do it, is when they accept you, they guarantee you at least 3 years of funding. Now, that may be research funding, which means basically you can spend 100% of your time working on research and taking classes. Or if you don't find research funding, that means basically they'll employ you as a TA or as some other kind of supporting role for the department. Realistically, that 3 years turns into as many years as you need. It's pretty rare for someone to have to leave because of funding problems, especially since while I was there, the growth in the undergrad population has been very larger than computer science, which means there's always TA roles available, right? You can always get your tuition waived and your stipend paid by taking a TA role, if nothing else. So when I came in, I didn't come in with any research funding. My advisor did have some research funding if I'd wanted to work on specific things. So his area of expertise was kind of software-defined networking, which has a lot to do, or software-defined radio as well, which has a lot to do with kind of how do we build modern wireless radio systems? How do we build modern wireless kind of data center networking centers or wired data center networking systems? So there were some opportunities to work on things in there and kind of work on funded projects. But I explored those topics a little bit, and they didn't thrill me the way that I was hoping for, right? And the wireless stuff started to get a little bit too close to comfort to some of the things I tried to leave in electrical engineering. We're suddenly back to hard math and like abstract concepts, and I can't just sit down and bash out some code to solve the problem trivially. The networking stuff certainly had some interest. It was a field that was kind of expanding a lot while I was there. But at the end of the day, I just never really landed on a project that I loved. So I started to do a little bit of work in those areas, but I pretty quickly, by the end of the first year or so, had started to shift my focus more towards security. Having had this interest a little bit, obviously I'd interviewed for this job in the area, and I'd done a little bit of work in undergrad kind of exploring it, but this was all also at about the same time that like Edward Snowden was happening, right? So like we're simultaneously starting to see these major revelations about potential surveillance abuses by major governments, while the use of computers is growing exponentially, the use of the internet's growing exponentially, the amount of data people are exposing online is growing exponentially. So it really did start to present this nexus of interesting problems of like, man, information security is going to be one of the major problems of the next, you know, the next decade and probably beyond. And I was interested in it. I found it really interesting. Information security is a nice mix of a lot of different disciplines within computer science. You know, you do have to know some systems level computer science. You have to be able to do some systems administration type stuff. You have to be able to do some user interface and some kind of usability type stuff, because a lot of security failures at the end of the day are really just usability failures. You can build the most secure system in the world, but if the average user can't use it, it's like, well, what good is it? It's a system that three people in the world can use. That doesn't help the 99.999% of people that you actually want to be able to use it. So,
and doesn't it all, it also comes down to understanding the human factor.
Yeah, there's information security is a subset of the wider security realm in general, right? So today it's computers worried about locking down, but a lot of the concepts of information security have to do with economics and have to do with sociology and have to do with psychology. I mean, these are problems we've been solving since humans have had security concerns, right? Like since people have had safes, since people have had banks. We've adopted the concepts, and there are certainly new issues that arise in the digital realm, but a lot of security engineering at the end of the day has been around a lot longer than computers have been around. So we apply these concepts to computers today, but it's not like we're necessarily inventing a field that has never existed. There are security engineering concepts that transcend and continue to transcend the digital age itself.
So securing secrets and managing trust in modern computing applications. You had mentioned it before. Your PhD was not answering a single question. You were going more towards a path of applied research. And walk me through what that was. How do you get from at the end of your first year of grad school going, well, I'm not interested in Wi-Fi, I'm interested in this, in the more understanding the security thing. What's that path look like? Because this is certainly, it's application of ideas, but how do you support how do you support the answers to the questions you were asking?
Sure. So for me, it was somewhat organic. It wasn't like I all of a sudden at the end of my first year of the PhD program, like snapped my fingers and thought, well, this is what my dissertation's going to be on. It was more at that stage, you know, you end your first year of your PhD program, going into your second year, you're still kind of in the heart of taking a lot of classes, but you're starting to look for things you can do some research on.
What are those classes? Real quick, we'll get back to it. What are the classes that you're taking then? Are you taking more higher level coding classes? Are you taking like a philosophy class? I mean,
yeah, so it can really run the gamut. So the general requirement in a lot of PhD programs is basically you need to take 30 credit hours of classes, right? So it turns out to be about 10 courses overall, which is generally the same requirement for the master's. The difference is then the PhD has another 30 credit hours of dissertation work on top of that. Within at CU, and as it is in many places, you generally have to split that that coursework half between kind of just being fundamentals of computer science at the grad level. And often there's an encouragement to kind of make that fairly broad. So they like you to take some courses in multiple subdisciplines of computer science. And then the other half of that tends to be something more focused on specifically your field or kind of your subfield, what you're interested in studying. So for me, I mean, yeah, I did take a course in like computer science theory, right? Like the basic kind of underlying theory of computation and theory of computer science. And that kind of got a little more into the math. I took some courses in compilers, which is not my area of expertise. But if you kind of want to understand, again, that lower level computer science interface, the how do we turn programs we write into instructions a processor actually can do something with, it's a good kind of course to really have a fundamental understanding of that. So a lot of these are just, half of these were kind of just advanced computer science fundamental type courses. So things like compilers, things like theory of computation. I then took kind of some courses just to broaden my understanding. So I took like a survey course on human-computer interaction, which is an entire subfield in and of itself. Basically, it is the discipline that deals with user interface design and everything else that comes with how humans interact with computers. So it tends to have a lot of sociology in it, a lot of psychology in it, and definitely dovetails off kind of the existing, again, pre-computer science world of how do you build an airplane cockpit that works for more than one human, right? Or how do you kind of start thinking about how do we build machines and build equipment that actually augments human capability instead of interfering with it? I wanted to take that both because I find it interesting, but also because I recognized that in security, we have a lot of these same problems. So it's, I am not a HCI expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I wanted to at least...
HCI, human-computer interaction. Interaction, okay.
I'm
the acronym King as well, and it drives... Yes.
I wanted to at least have like some grounding in it, right? Like I wanted to kind of see what people were talking about. So I had a lot of fun with that course. I really enjoyed it. Where you get to kind of read a very broad base of items from across the spectrum, all dealing with this, what does it mean to have computers in society and how do computers interact with them kind of questions. So I took some stuff like that. I then did take kind of a series of courses more in the security realm, right? Like I took some advanced security seminar courses where you're just reading a couple of papers from the InfoSec world every week. Took some courses kind of in advanced networking because I had been studying a little bit of that at the same time. But yeah, more just kind of specialized courses in the security networking and systems space. So operating systems courses, stuff like that.
Gotcha. Okay, so then roll me into that next 30 hours of the dissertation. Where do you, a biologist that I talked to in a previous episode, she's down in Central America studying populations of specific animals within different altitudes. So tell me how you get to securing secrets to this dissertation. Sure.
So I'm kind of moving into my sophomore year. I'm starting to get this coursework wrapped up, and I'm starting to look for something I can work on that will give me a paper or something, right? Because you generally need a handful of publications before they will award you your PhD. So I was looking for, not necessarily something that would turn into my dissertation, but a project that I could turn into a small conference paper or something like that. Like I said, at the same time, I'd kind of had this growing interest in security. I'd seen things like the Snowden revelations come out, so I knew there were some hard problems, specifically in the realm of, well, how do we encrypt data on a laptop? How do we encrypt data on a cell phone? How do we kind of secure this data that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis? And it turns out the encryption questions there are pretty well answered. Like, we know how to do encryption and all of that. But encryption is just the first step in what's actually a much more complex system. It's just how you secure the data itself. Once you encrypt it, you still have this notion of, well, now there exists a key. There exists some secret that basically you need to unlock this data. And what we do with those secrets has a lot of bearing on both the overall security of the system and the overall usability of the system. So I started thinking, well, maybe people haven't looked so much at this. We've solved the encryption problem, but we haven't solved the, okay, well, now what? You have encrypted data, but how do I get that key in a manner where you can share a document with someone while still having it be encrypted without having to like go walk over to their house and hand them the key itself, right? I mean, at that point, what's the point of sharing the document online anyway? So there were a number of kind of hard questions in this realm of how do you do encryption key management in a manner that still enables a lot of these modern sharing type use cases, enables the fact that I might want to look at something both on my phone and on my laptop, realizing that that means, well, now I need to access that key from two different places where it might not exist. So it kind of, I had that initial inkling of there's probably an interesting problem here. And that led me toward this, just an effort to code something to solve it, right? This is kind of the applied side again. It's the, okay, well, this problem seems to be here. Now, what does it mean if we sit down and try to actually write a program that manages these keys for us or gives us a framework for kind of sharing keys with other people or using keys as this proxy for a lot of this other security we get via encryption? So that was kind of my first foray into the work. So by end of sophomore year, I'd like written this little system, gotten like a little conference paper after it. Definitely hadn't generalized the idea to be kind of beyond encryption keys on like cell phones and laptops in this fairly specific use case. But
you hadn't had your aha moment yet.
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily. I think I'd started to get to the point where I'm like, well, this is a problem. And if I'm going to be here for another 3 years, I seem to like working on it. Also, at this point, you know, we're well into sophomore year, coming up on junior year, like because it takes a year to get a conference paper out or something anyway.
I like how you refer to your PhD program as freshman, junior. I think it's funny. You know what? We all had, you know, we had those issues in high school. We had the same in college, and I like how you refer to it.
I mean, people do that. People do generally refer to it as first, second, third year. Mm-hmm. It's more just...
No,
mental
I get
click.
It. Yeah, that's fine. Just
sure,
you know.
Sure. But anyway, so I'm going into my third year at this point, and it's like, well, now I need to start thinking about how do I get from here to a PhD within the next couple of years. And it's like, well, I've started to establish some work in this space. Let's see if I can generalize it. So I did, going throughout all of this, is kind of, I didn't fully answer this question earlier, but I did have quite a bit of flexibility to choose what I was working on because I had never really attached myself directly to research funding. So for my first year and a half or so, I TA'd a couple of courses. From there forward, though, the CS department had a large kind of computer science lab they ran, and they were also looking for someone to support various educational technology initiatives within the department. So they needed someone to kind of solve the problem of, well, we have 40 different classes. The undergrads all come in with different computers. How do we get all of these undergrads with all of the different computers to like have an environment set up where these 30 classes can rely on some basis of a lab environment that they can work in, basically? Because we long passed the point where you could just expect everyone to walk into the school computer lab that you'd configured in a very specific manner. Everyone wanted to use their own laptop now, but getting from 10 different models of Windows laptops to 10 different models of OS X Apple laptops to various other weird things that students show up to college with to they can all run the same lab or they can all complete the same homework assignment for a specific course kind of becomes a non-trivial problem. So the university needed someone to solve this. I had the advantage of my advisor was kind of heading up the group that needed to solve this. So I'm like, well, you have a problem and I need a job. And I kind of ended up taking the job working as that. So I moved from being a TA to being what they call like a GA, just a general assistant or graduate assistant, supporting the computer science department in particular is kind of both their lab space and their educational technology initiative. So I was doing quite a bit of work on building systems that we could then deploy to students so that they could all have a similar environment for completing homework on, building systems to help us grade student homework more quickly or to kind of test student code and stuff like that, which was interesting in its own right. And actually, I have some kind of computer science education conference papers that came out of that work. But that did mean that was where my funding was coming from. It meant I had to spend 20 hours a week doing that kind of work. But it meant the other 20 hours of my week, I could basically work on whatever I wanted to work on. I wasn't tied to a specific grant. I wasn't tied to a specific research initiative. I had my advisor, who had been my advisor all along, and he obviously had his recommendations. But it wasn't like I had to do a specific ask as part of his research project in order to satisfy some goal within a larger lab type initiative.
Okay, I want to... When you decided that you wanted to go to school and you wanted to have... You saw this ball out there, this goal of probably getting your PhD. What at that point, what did you see yourself doing after that? Because the next part of that question is, did you like being a TA and sitting and standing in front of a whole bunch of fresh faces writing on the whiteboard? Or did you see yourself being more in the applied side of the world after your PhD?
Yeah, so...
And I'll probably ask that question again once we talk about finishing up the dissertation.
Sure.
Because it may have changed, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I've always liked teaching. I enjoyed being a TA. There are things about it that nobody enjoys, right? It means you're grading papers. It means you're actually like preparing lectures. I mean, it's exhausting. I don't know how people who are actual full-time teachers, especially outside of the college realm, do it, where you're teaching like 5 or 6 classes in a day. But even teaching like 3 lecture sections in a day, it's a lot of work. It takes a lot out of you when you're up there lecturing. But I did always enjoy it. I liked it a lot. That said, I also liked building things. And in particular, I wanted to kind of work in a field where the work I was doing would have an effect on a lot of end users. So I kind of always knew, at least right away, I didn't want to go directly into academia afterwards. I could see coming back into academia at some point, and having the PhD is certainly a nice prerequisite in your back pocket if you want to do that. But I kind of always knew I wanted to at least go into the private sector for a little while. And there, I think what I kind of saw the PhD as being something that can open some doors in terms of leadership positions or in terms of the ability to kind of lead on projects or lead on teams. I also, and this didn't really happen until kind of my 4th or 5th year, but I'd simultaneously started doing some public policy work in this space. So I spent a summer out in DC working for the Center for Democracy and Technology. I spent a semester as kind of the lone non-law student in the CU Law Clinic's technology policy group that takes cases from clients related to various aspects of technology policy and issues with technology. And in the public policy space, I mean, for better or worse, having the extra letters next to your name tends to make people take you more seriously.
Well, absolutely. And in that respect, sorry if I cut you off. In that respect, the doctor of philosophy, really, you really take advantage of that, because you really are looking at this not just from the applied science of computer science of security, but you're touching this on the public policy side, on the legal side as well. So as you're doing that, how does that form your dissertation?
Yeah, so I'm kind of simultaneously right working on multiple tracks here. So I developed kind of the initial iteration of this key management program. I set out to kind of rebuild it from scratch because the first system always sucks. Often the second system sucks more, but we all think it won't, so we build it anyway. So I was simultaneously working on some programming to kind of expand these ideas and like see if I could build a more general, more scalable, like more real world version of this system that I had applied. But yeah, at the same time, I was like, well, there's interesting legal questions here. There's interesting public policy questions here. So all of these things kind of started to shape up to what ultimately became chapters in my dissertation, right? So there's a couple of chapters in my dissertation on the actual code I wrote, the 2 variants of the system I built. There's a chapter in my dissertation on kind of the public policy issues that are at play here. And you pretty quickly get into the, especially when you're dealing with things with encryption, there's a lot of interesting questions over, well, how do you kind of deal with the rule of law and the fact that we've traditionally had a society that, in certain cases at least, recognizes the right of the people or the right of the government to have access to data, right? I mean, this is what a warrant is for, right? We recognize that there is, in fact, a compelling investigative need in certain cases to read someone's documents. And now we need to reconcile that with the fact that, well, we now have a technology that might make that mathematically impossible. And what does that mean? And how do we deal with that? And there's a lot of interesting questions and public policy things that come into play there, many of which we have not resolved and that we are still fighting about. There's other interesting public policy questions when it comes to things like, we do have security problems. We see data leaks a lot, right? We see big companies mismanaging data, often for very dumb reasons. So when you're trying to take a more holistic viewpoint to the, well, how do we actually increase user security? One side of it's the technology, but there's definitely a regulatory component there, right? There's a notion of, what does it mean to have liability for a data leak? We don't really have that liability today. I mean, you have a major data leak that exposes your data. At best, maybe you get like a few free months of credit monitoring, right? Like, there hasn't really...
We won't say the Experian word here.
I know, or anyone else. It's not just Experian.
Well, you're absolutely right. I work in the insurance industry and have had... I'm on the claims side of it. Mm-hmm. I'm a claims advocate consultant. Mostly mm-hmm. I play in the property space, but I've had an opportunity to be involved in cyber, in some of these, you know, in cyber insurance. It's still very much a young, growing industry, or issue. But yeah, it is the compromising of whether Experian had, you know, yeah, Experian exposed, you know, everything about me to whoever it was. I've also gotten notices because Aetna got hacked.
Yep.
I've also been on the insurance side of other healthcare folks getting hacked and a hotel group getting hacked. So it is interesting. We're talking, you mentioned it, it's not just a hardware or a software problem. It's a human interaction problem.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's definitely, it's a human interaction problem, and it's a law and policy problem. I mean, again, we haven't really gotten to the point of society where we necessarily properly recognize the harms that come from this kind of a data breach, right? Which is why there isn't really much compensation for it. And at the end of the day, there really isn't much punishment or deterrent for companies that have this happen, right? It's not like if you're a drug company and you release a drug that inadvertently kills a million people, like, that's the end of your drug company, and there's probably people going to jail. You know, if you're a healthcare company that inadvertently releases the private and unchangeable medical data of a million of your subscribers, you're like, well, I guess that means a few months of regulation. I probably have to sit in the hot seat in front of Congress once or twice. But at the end of the day, the company is going to go on. The write-off is going to be manageable. And I might very well have insurance that covers any fallout from this. But there are all kinds of secondary interesting things that come in there. I mean, the insurance markets especially. It's like, yes, we would like companies to have insurance, mainly because we would like there to be strict liability for this. So it's an expensive event if you have this occur. And then ideally, to insure you against it, we have insurance companies that can actually look at things like, well, how good of a job you're doing, and use that to price their policies, which starts to set up some better incentive structures for companies to actually do the right thing in advance versus waiting for a major breach to happen and basically getting a slap on the wrist.
So where we got off topic here. How is this a dissertation then made up of some individual articles and some individual writings, or that share a theme across them, or is this a document unto itself?
Yeah, so it is. I mean, you do have the traditional like staple together thesis where you take your five papers that you've published or your three papers that you publish and you staple them together and throw an introduction and conclusion and call it your thesis. That's not what this is. Mine was a more cohesive document. It definitely has components. So several of the chapters in there, either before the dissertation was published or after I'd finished it, ended up becoming kind of individual papers and conferences. But the theme of the dissertation as a whole does kind of have this. It is dealing with this notion of what does it mean to manage secrets in the digital age? And how do we solve those problems, both from the technology standpoint, but also what does secret management mean on the policy side, right? Like, how do we extrapolate secrets that traditionally might be within the realm of the contents of your mind and thus have protection under certain amendments people love to claim when they're on trial for things they did, to now having an entire hard drive that maybe vastly expands the contents of your mind but can still be protected with one secret you can memorize. So there's all kinds of interesting problems that come into play there. But the dissertation itself does really kind of try to weave this story through the what's the history of this problem, what's kind of the existing ways we've tried to solve it, propose some new technology to maybe solve it better, and then let's talk about the policy implications, the societal implications, all of the other non-technical but equally as hard questions that come into play in this space.
How does this work specifically apply to what you're doing today?
Sure. Some of the systems I work on today are not dissimilar from some of the systems I was building for this work, right? I mean, this continues to be a problem. There are different ways of solving it. I proposed one approach, other people proposed other approaches. So on like the very direct side, I do work on some systems that aim to solve similar problems today. On the less direct side, I am still kind of actively involved in the policy front. I end up having to do a lot of work in my day job to kind of analyze what is the security problem here? What are the potential technical solutions? But then what are all of the other, you know, things that surround that? What are all of the non-technical implications? What are all of the potential usability problems? So just having the background and kind of being able to look at those sort of problems and know the different facets you should analyze and to have some understanding of the problems beyond the mere technical example being presented, I think is very useful in the kind of work I do today.
Do you see yourself moving more towards that, towards building policy? I get the sense in talking with you here that that's probably where your passion is going towards, is not so much writing the code, but really maybe helping to drive the conversation.
Yeah, and to be fair, I do love still writing code. I actually wish I got to write more code in my day job, right? Like, I get to write some code, but I do spend a lot of my time doing other stuff at this point. Long-term, I think that is the progression it'll take. For better or worse, I think the amount of coding I will do will probably stay constant or lessen over time. Because as it turns out, I mean, writing code's not easy, but it's a lot easier to find people who can write the code well than it is to find people who can kind of address some of these broader problems. So with the joys of specialization, if you are one of those people that kind of has some background or has some expertise in helping to address some of these wider problems, that tends to be where the demand takes you. And I do enjoy it. I enjoyed my time in DC. I could certainly see going back and doing some more very direct public policy work at some point. I could see continuing to work in companies like Twitter or other kind of large companies where you have these same kinds of issues at different levels. You know, maybe it's not dealing with the entire U.S. federal government, but it's a large institution. You have similar problems. You have a large user base. Like, these discussions and microcosms of them happen at all these different levels. And I do enjoy doing that kind of work. So I definitely think as I go on, the work I will do, I hope it will continue to have a technical component because I do enjoy the coding, but I think it's always going to have a strong kind of policy component, a strong societal component, a strong how do we solve the kind of wider problem here? How do we look at the entire system and come up with a solution versus the just how do we write the best code for a very specific technical implication?
You enjoy writing?
Writing code or writing like writing?
Writing.
I like both. I do enjoy writing. It's one of those things I do a lot of for work that isn't maybe the kind I would like love to do on my free time. But I have always enjoyed writing. Back in high school at Cherry Creek, actually, I ran an underground newspaper for a little while. So I've always enjoyed the writing side of this in some facet or another. I don't know if anyone says they enjoy writing a dissertation.
I haven't found that yet. I've found that there are people that enjoy aspects of it or portions of it, that, you know, having the 800-pound gorilla leaning over your shoulder of sure, get it done is not necessarily, you know, the fun part of it, but telling your story or getting, you know, getting this mass of information that you've pushed into your head into some semblance of cohesiveness on the page, you know, I can certainly appreciate the joy that you get from that. And, you know, oh man, I got that done. You know, there's a lot of that. It, you know, Twitter or, you know, even the undergrad kids that you may still run into, do you get a chance much to go up to Boulder? And I'm guessing you probably had a pretty good relationship with the folks at CU. You're an outside resource. I'm sure you get called often.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and sometimes inadvertently. So the side effect of having been the person that built a lot of the internal infrastructure that they're still using is you still get emails from confused freshmen at the start of the semester who like found your name in a help file somewhere and are like sending you emails even though you're no longer affiliated to ask you how to solve this problem. But yeah, I do get kind of the more intentional.
Do you still have a CU email address?
I do. They let you keep them forever. So yeah, that I will probably be getting emails from confused freshmen for at least the next decade until either they completely replace everything I built or that email address stops working. But more generally, I do try to stay in touch with campus. So while I was at CU, I was fairly active with the CU Hacking Club, which is kind of the security affinity group. So I'll try to go up. That continues to go on, and I'll try to go up and give a talk there now once a semester or so. I'm still at the law clinic I was part of. I try to go up and talk to them at least once a semester or so, because they always are looking for, again, they're a bunch of law students. They like to bring in someone with a technical background. They don't always have someone in-house for that. So I enjoy doing that kind of stuff. I like talking with them. I do like having a chance to kind of keep a foot on what's going on the CU campus.
When you're talking to undergrads, those fresh faces that are looking for some direction, you know, we're still hearing that, you know, computer science, engineering, those are the places where there's still a great need. If a young kid comes up to you and asks, "What should I do?" What's the answer you give them?
Yeah. I think you're right. I think engineering does have a lot of need. Although I would also say, I think a lot of the hardest problems we face at this stage aren't traditional engineering problems, right? I mean, looking at Twitter or Facebook or any of these big social media sites, especially with the news over the last few months, I mean, writing the code is hard and there are certainly interesting technical challenges there to solve, but equally as hard and arguably unsolved problems there have a lot more to do with how do we regulate user content, right? Like, how do we deal with open forms and the way humans might behave on there? Like, these are hard and interesting, very basic human and sociological type questions that I don't think we have good answers to.
So that brings up kind of an idea or a point in the back of my brain, because, you know, I've got two kids that are trying to figure it out for themselves. What's the right path? And we've heard of, you know, so many young people these days going down a path too high tech that's not in that traditional 4-year institution. Are we looking, in your experience, because of, you know, you've got that PhD behind your name, you bring some value into the conversation. Is there a point where if a kid just wants to write code, that's, I don't necessarily want to see that's a trade, but it is almost like a trade because you are building something, whether it's a plumber or an electrician, you're writing code. Is that an educational path that might be different than, say, somebody who needs to have the coding experience and trade and knowledge, but also needs a more rounded education that provides them?
Yeah.
I'm going here.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And this is not the first. So this conversation has existed in other realms for years now over this notion of coding as a trade versus really kind of what's on the other side is coding as a more traditional engineering discipline, where, again, the average public doesn't think about this, but at least within engineering, there has always been that ethos of it's more complex than the technical problem. Like, to be a good engineer, you need to have a wider understanding of kind of the impacts, and you need to have kind of a more well-rounded understanding. You need to be able to communicate and all of these other things that kind of come into play with the notion that the technical solution itself is inadequate. Computer science as a field is very young, right? I mean, computer science has existed as a standalone discipline for, if you're willing to push it, maybe 50 years, right? And in its modern incarnation, it's existed for maybe 20 years. This is by far a younger discipline than almost every other form of engineering, or for that matter, every other discipline that you could get a degree in at this point. And because of that, I think the discipline has a lot of room to go in terms of maturity. So many people majoring in computer science and who take jobs in the computer industry basically have the title of computer engineer, but there is no accredited program for computer engineering, right? You are not a professional engineer. You do not get a PE designation, right? Like, in some states, you can't legally even call yourself an engineer without such a designation. That designation doesn't even exist for computer science yet. And with it, that whole notion of there's a set of ethics you need to pay attention to. There's a set of communication standards you need to pay attention to. There's going to be regulation you need to pay attention to, right? There's going to be norms. There's going to be all of this other stuff that other fields have developed largely in response to the fact that the technical problem itself is more complicated than just the technical merits that computer science just doesn't have yet. I think we're going to get there. I think it's going to take a little while. You know, today there is plenty of jobs where you can just be a good coder and that's enough. I think that may not be true 10 years from now. I think as the field matures, you may see some of this. You may see kind of coding itself go a little bit more toward the trade side, and then computer engineering actually turn into a real form of engineering, which I don't think it necessarily is today, where the implications go well beyond coding and you're expected to kind of have an additional set of skills at play there.
Is there a need, just as you sit here today, is there a need also to have some ethical or more humanist educational influences in that computer? And I don't know if, you know, I'm not an engineer, didn't go through a program. I couldn't tell you two classes that an engineer has to take beyond maybe math and physics and a materials class. But at some point, do we need to have the basic education of ethics and humanities a bigger focus in these brains that are coming out of colleges today?
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. If you look at other forms of engineering, ones that have been around a lot longer, they often do require you to take like an ethics course. Now, given one ethics course in college is not going to solve the problem here, right? But it at least is an acknowledgement in those fields of the fact that there are challenging questions here that go beyond the mere finding the best technical solution. I think also, as the field grows in maturity, and you're starting to see this a little bit, you don't need everyone to, I mean, not everyone's going to have the same skill sets, nor would you want them to.
Right.
I mean, that's simply impossible. Like, it is a big field. It is a growing field. There is going to be specialization. Like, not everyone necessarily has to be the best coder. Similarly, not everyone has to be an ethics expert. Right. I think everyone needs enough exposure to kind of the range of topics to realize that there are these issues and these topics exist. They don't necessarily need the level of specialization to be able to solve every problem within the field. But I do think as we diversify, and you're seeing this some today, unfortunately, at least for now, a lot of the kind of high paying jobs are still centered more around coding talent than they are around kind of all of the other complicated things that come into play here. I think we're going to see that start to shift. You definitely do have other roles available today. I mean, there are a lot of people working in policy, working in civil society, working in law, who are asking some of these hard questions and looking at some of these ethical issues. They're not making the paychecks that you're making in Silicon Valley yet, but I think as the field matures, as we see things like regulation mature, as we start to have broader and more mature conversations around some of these problems, I think you're going to see a heightening of the value we assign to the non-coding roles. And hopefully that'll correspond to them getting equally as ridiculous paychecks that the rest of Silicon Valley has grown accustomed to.
A question I like to ask folks on the podcast is, would 18-year-old Andy be happy with where 29-year-old Andy is?
Probably. I think so. I mean, I always knew I wanted to go into a technical field. It's definitely meandered a bit, and I've branched out into areas that I maybe didn't expect to. But, you know, 18-year-old Andy had political ideas. You know, 18-year-old Andy liked to write, and 18-year-old Andy liked to build things. And 29-year-old Andy likes the same things and maybe a slightly different mix of components. But a lot of it's the, I think, still true to that older ideal if it's been manifested in slightly different ways.
Andy, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, my pleasure, Ted. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks for shoveling it piled high and deep.
Ah, I enjoyed. Thanks.
Thanks again to Andy Saylor. Really appreciate your time, Andy. Fascinating journey. And I know this is, you know, still under 20 episodes and just really amazed at the talent that's out there and what's driving people to get their PhDs. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again here in a couple of weeks. Got some fun interviews lined up, and I'm also headed to New York City. I wonder what I can dig up there. I think I'll pack my shovel and my microphone. Thanks again for listening, and don't forget to check us out on the interwebs, and if you like what you heard, please give me a review on whatever podcast distribution channel you are listening on. Thanks again, and as always, keep shoveling.